people with real weaknesses, just like us. Torah's for moms and dads and kids, too. So, go study Torah. Go learn Torah. We begin an inquiry into the book of Hebrews, from which we were able to draw some conclusions. For example, we concluded that the writer of the book of Hebrews was a Hellenist Jew, an acquaintance of the famous Timothy, and probably an acquaintance of the famous Paul and Luke. He was in the Pauline circle. He was in the clique. We also concluded that this writer, the writer of the book of Hebrews, was writing from somewhere in Italy, maybe Rome, maybe near to Rome. We concluded that the epistle was being written around the time of the death of Paul, 64 AD CE, shortly thereafter, but before the Jewish revolt of 67. So that narrowed it down. I mean, that narrows it down. We're looking at about a 3-year window of opportunity to write this book. We also concluded that the book was being written and addressed to a group of believing Jews known as the Hebrews, which is not all Jews, not even all believing Jews. But the Hebrews was a specific title of, it's what the Hellenist Greek-speaking Jewish believers from the diaspora called the Hebrew and Aramaic-speaking believing community of the land of Israel, the Hebrews. So all of that we covered last week, and in addition, we sampled some of the general argumentation style of the writer of the book of Hebrews. You remember this argument he made that, we looked at this passage, the writer compared Mount Sinai and the experience of receiving the Torah, which we read about in last week's Torah reading, with encountering salvation through Yeshua at Mount Zion. So he said, you've got these two mountains, Mount Sinai, Mount Zion. This was Hebrews 12. I said 13, it was 12. He said, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched, that is burning with fire, like Mount Sinai. But he said, you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You've come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. And he, in saying this, he was employing this very rabbinic argument, this method of argumentation, kol v'chomer, from the light to the heavy. How much more so? That sort of thing. He was saying, if you took the Torah at Mount Sinai seriously, with all that thunder and lightning and smoke, how much more so should you take this encounter at Mount Zion seriously, with thousands of angels in joyful assembly? So it was not a statement of antithesis like we usually read it, as in Sinai, Zion, opposites or something, new replaces old. Instead, it was a statement of gravity. If Sinai, the revelation through Moses, was weighty, how much more weighty is this revelation through Yeshua? That particular piece of theological reasoning is the main device that will be employed through the entire book. We'll see it employed repeatedly in chapter after chapter. Another example of it. The author makes a midrash on today's Torah portion, which is found in the book of Exodus, chapter 24. This is from today's reading. It says, Moses then went down. I'm reading Exodus 24, beginning in verse 4. It says, Moses then went down. He wrote down everything the Lord had said. He got up early the next morning. He built an altar at the foot of the mountain and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young Israelite men, and they offer burnt offerings and peace offerings, bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half the blood, put it in bowls. The other half he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant. He read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey." And Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, splashed it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant, which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." That's from this week's Torah reading. The author of the book of Hebrews takes this very passage, and kol v'chomer, points on this text, Find it in Hebrews 9. You don't have to turn there. I'll just read it to you. He goes from the light to the heavy. He says, if the giving of the Torah on earth had to be put into effect by blood, how much more so did the heavenly reality need to be put into effect by blood? So he says in Hebrews chapter 9, this is, I'll read it to you. You can read, follow along if you want to turn there. I'm starting in verse 18. Just going to read a few verses. It says, even the first covenant was not put into effect without blood. When Moses had proclaimed every commandment of the Torah to the people, he took the blood of calves with water, together with water, scarlet wool, branches of hyssop, and sprinkled the scroll and all the people. You notice we didn't hear about this, the hyssop and that sort of thing in the Torah? So he's working with some Midrashic tradition there. He said, this is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you to keep. In the same way, he sprinkled with the blood both the tabernacle and everything used in its ceremonies. In fact, the Torah requires nearly everything to be cleansed with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Therefore, it was necessary then for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these sacrifices. The copies of the heavenly things being the Torah itself, the covenant itself, the tabernacle itself. Those are the copies of the reality. If it was necessary for the copies to be purified with these sacrifices, how much more so the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these? It's called the Homer. How much more so? And he goes on, of course, to make the argument that this is why the Messiah had to die and how his blood is efficacious for us. But I want you to notice something. That is the book of Hebrews. We could pretty much stop right there and I could say, okay, go read now. Because I think that is the essence of everything you're going to find in this book. But I want you to notice something. The argument falls apart immediately if our writer is addressing a community of people that do not assume the eternal validity of Torah and live by it. Because if the Hebrews that this is being written to, addressed in the book of Hebrews, were themselves not Torah observant, if they had dismissed the Torah as obsolete, then how can you say, just as the Torah, how much more so is Yeshua obsolete, irrelevant? You understand? I mean, it's a small point, but an important point. Because as I said last week, the general Christian interpretation of the book of Hebrews is that it is written to non-observant Jewish Christians who are in danger of straying back into Torah observance, God forbid. But what does the Bible tell us about this group of believers? I mean, setting all the commentaries aside for a moment, what does the Bible tell us about the group of believers called the Hebrews, as we find them in the book of Acts? We find Luke paints a pretty careful portrait of them continually in the temple, devoted to the prayers, not prayers, the prayers, breaking bread together, fellowshipping together, always in the scriptures. Thousands and thousands, James says, myriads and myriads of Jewish believers, all of them zealous for the Torah, devout, observant men. These are all quotes from Acts. We even see them, we see four believers from the Hebrews community taking Nazirite vows and participating in the temple worship and sacrifices almost at the end of the book. Those are all biblical descriptions of this community. Those are the people to whom this letter is addressed. And it's only because of their love and because of their observance for the Torah, for the law, that the writer of this epistle is able to make that a priori argument that he's making. If that, how much more so this? So, keep that in mind. I mean, that's it. That's the key. Now, the rest was just fun. Turn back to Hebrews chapter 1. And we'll get right into the text today. I'm reading from the New International Version as always. But if you really want to do some serious study of the book of Hebrews, you need to chuck the New International Version. We'll do our best, but probably the biggest problem with the New International Version's rendering of the book of Hebrews is the tense of the verbs. This is just a well-known fact that the verb tenses are fiddled with. So we'll try and pay attention to that as we encounter it. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, and through whom He made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of His being, sustaining all things by His powerful word. After He had provided purification for sins, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty in heaven, so He became as much superior to the angels as the name He has inherited is superior to theirs. There's a certain affinity in this opening, these Christological statements, with the opening of the Gospel of John. And I'm thinking of Colossians chapter 1 as well. We can kind of connect the lines between these different statements. But this verse 4, it says, He became as much superior to the angels as the name He has inherited is superior to theirs. What is the name He has inherited? If I went to Philippians, I would say, obviously, it is the divine name, the name above all names. But here in Hebrews, that's not the case. Although, I mean, that's a separate issue. Here in Hebrews, name is being used as title. He means it as in the title that Messiah has inherited. That is, the Son of God. Did you know Son of God can be used as a title? All these years, I used to think that He was called the Son of God because of the virgin birth. Turns out, Son of God is not a description of Messiah's birth. It is a title for the Davidic king taken from 2 Samuel. And from the Psalms, as we'll see. So Paul is able to say in the book of Romans that He rose and God made Him Son of God. So it has a different connotation when it's used as a title. To say Son of God is to say the King, the promised King. And that's the sense in which it's being used, although it also obviously the father and son relationship and such, and this is what the Master brings to it, that, you know, I and the Father are one, and the beauty of His statements in the book of John. But here in Hebrews, we are saying Son of God as a title. Just listen to it. Verse 4. He became as much superior to the angels as the title Son of God He has inherited is superior to theirs. For to which of the angels did God ever say, You are My Son? Today I have become your Father. Psalm 2:7. Or again, to which of the angels did He ever say, I will be His Father, He will be My Son? 2 Samuel 7:14. Those are the texts that the title is being brought from. So the entire first chapter of Hebrews is dedicated to proving this point, that Messiah is superior in situation and in station to the angels. And the argumentation is like reading, it's like reading the Midrash Rabbah or the Talmud straight. I mean, it's very technical, it's very rabbinic, just grabbing a little piece here, kind of stitching them together. And you know, I think, you know, God willing, next week we'll explore the proof texts that He uses here in chapter 1 and their relationships to one another and how He stitches them together and learn about a little bit about the way the first century believers did Bible study. It's interesting. For now, just skip to chapter 2. I want to show you why He troubles to make the point at all. It says in chapter 2, verse 1, we must pay more careful attention, therefore, to do what we have heard, so that we do not drift away. For if the message spoken by angels was binding, and every violation and disobedience received its just punishment, how shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation? This salvation, which was first announced by the Lord, was confirmed to us by those who heard him. The key to the understanding this text is to answer the question, what is the message that was spoken by angels, of which every violation and disobedience receives its just punishment? It's obviously the Torah. Listen to the new American Standard. It's a better translation. It says, "For this reason, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation?" So you hear the argument? Once again, kol v'homer, from the light to the heavy. If the Torah spoken through angels proved unalterable, unchanging, steadfast, and the Son is superior to angels who spoke that unaltering, steadfast message, how much more so must we pay attention to what is said of him and by him? Again, if you are paying careful attention to the Torah spoken through the angels, how much more so should you pay careful attention to the message spoken by him who's greater than the angels? There you go. That's chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2. But again, the argument assumes a community that's living a Torah life devoted to Torah. That's the logic. That's the argument. Because if they weren't, then it just all falls down. It says, if it was alterable, how much more so is this alterable? We'll sort out the details next week, God willing. But it raises a problem for me. What does it mean the Torah was spoken through angels? I mean, I can almost hear the rabbi standing up and shouting at me. From the mouth of the Lord, through the hand of Moses, Vezot HaTorah, no intercessor. Wasn't the Torah spoken directly by God? Vayedeber Adonai el Moshe vayomer. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, and at Sinai, all the people heard the voice. Wasn't the Torah spoken by God himself? And if so, then why does it say through angels? I'll give you some other New Testament examples of this theology. Acts 7:53, Stephen the Hellenist, standing before the Hebraic Sanhedrin, charges the Hebraic Sanhedrin, and he has the chutzpah to quote the Septuagint to do it. The Greek version of the Torah, he charges them with, he says, and this is the guy on trial, he says to them, "You who have received the Torah that was put into effect through angels have not obeyed it." But there it is again. What does he mean, the Torah that was put into effect through angels? The book of Galatians, chapter 3, verse 19, Paul says, "The Torah was put into effect through angels by a mediator." Al pei Adonai beyad Moshe. The mediator is Moses. In the hand of Moses. So why does Paul say the Torah was put into effect through angels to a mediator? Wasn't it God to Moses? Isn't that the point? God spoke to Moses. Moses could hear God speaking directly to him. To understand this, we need to re-examine what we know about angels. You know, when we think of angels, we tend to think in terms of the angel Gabriel or Michael, Sarim. Those are angel princes. It's one type of angel. Last week in Isaiah 6, we saw another type of angel, seraphim, burning ones. As it says here in the book of Hebrews, he makes his servants flames of fire. There are many types of angels. Since the word angel just means messenger, in Hebrew and Greek, Malach is messenger. Any being used by God to deliver a message or to run an errand is an angel. So, the prophet Malachi, his name is my angel because he's God's prophet. So there's all types of angels. There's seraphim, burning ones, Ezekiel saw cherubim. The cherubim are near ones. John saw chayim, living ones or living creatures. Ezekiel saw ophanim, rolling ones, wheels. Then there's the sarim, the angel princes, the archangels, the personalities that we're a little bit familiar with. And the sarim have sentience. They have free will, it seems, like Michael, who is like God. Gavriel, the strength of God. Raphael, God heals, and so on. And then there's the fallen angels, whose names we won't speak here. And then there's the vast, innumerable Zavaot, the angelic hosts, the court of God, who are described as rivers of fire issuing forth from under the throne of glory to carry out His will, created for a single purpose, a single messenger errand in the administration of creation. They discharge their duty and pass out of existence as new ones are poured into existence. In rabbinic lore, angels were very, very much involved with the giving of the Torah in sort of a, well, like the story I told the kids. There's yet another kind of angel, though, and this one probably gets the most press. I want to just try to share my impression of this angel. This is what I would call a representational angel. I just made it up, you know, but it's the kind of angel that appears to Abraham. Abraham sees three men. He assumes they're Arabs. Two of them turn out to be messenger angels who are going to Sodom to deliver a message, to check into something, run an errand. The third is the angel of the Lord. And he speaks directly for God in the first person voice. But he's not really God. He's the angel of the Lord, a projection, a metaphysical entity animated by God in time and space so that God can interact with the finite, the human, and the mortal. Because, I mean, think about this. This is a problem for God, just like it's a problem for us. How else is the infinite, uncontainable God, whose essence is described as consuming fire, dwelling in deep darkness, unapproachable, unknowable, how is he supposed to have a conversation with Abraham? What does he do? He creates an angel, a messenger, to speak through, to animate, to interact with. So it is the angel of the Lord that Abraham encounters, that appears to Isaac. Jacob wrestles. I don't believe it is Yeshua disguised as an angel, as we are sometimes taught and believe. Rather, it is a mask of God, a substitute, a mask that God puts on so He can interact with mortals. That's my understanding of the angel of the Lord. We read about this in Exodus 3. Moses was tending the flock. Out in the wilderness, and he led his flock to the far side. He came to Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flames of the fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I'll go over and see this strange sight, why the bush doesn't burn up. When he had gone over to take a look, God called to him from inside the bush. Who's inside the bush? The angel of the Lord is inside the bush. God called to him from inside the bush. Moses, Moses. Is it the Lord in the bush or is it the angel of the Lord in the bush? Is it the Lord speaking in the bush or the angel of the Lord speaking in the bush? It is the Lord speaking through this mask of the angel of the Lord. Turn to Exodus 23, today's Torah reading. This Torah put into effect through angels is spoken of as we come to the end of these commandments and stipulations, Mishpatim. It says in verse 20, see, Exodus 23, verse 20, see, I am sending an angel ahead of you to guard you along the way and to bring you to the place I have prepared. Pay attention to him and listen to what he says. Do not rebel against him. He will not forgive your rebellion since my name is in him. Who is this angel that will lead Israel? Who is this angel that will punish rebellion? Who is this angel in whom God's name is placed? What would you call such an angel? Angel of the Lord. Now, you know, this angelology, this is very mysterious stuff. And it may, you know, I think it's the writer of the book of Hebrews is playing on a technicality here. It's a technicality he's pointing out. But technically speaking, the Torah is spoken through angels, albeit the angel of the Lord. Nonetheless, it is an angelic manifestation of God. Technically speaking, it's angelic. So here's what he says. Here's what he's saying back in Hebrews, back in the book of Hebrews. He says, in former days, God spoke to us through angels. The Torah itself was spoken through angelic medium. But the one titled Son of God is higher than angels and angelic medium. So then, if the Torah spoken through angels is steadfast, unchanging, binding, how much more so the word spoken through the Son? So be careful that we don't drift away. You know, he's saying, would you, Hebrew community, Jerusalem believers, would you consider drifting away from the Torah? Of course not. How much more so should we never drift away from the revelation of Yeshua? Chapter 2, he says, we must pay more careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard so that we do not drift away. You know, when you think about how many people move from this movement into a full conversion and deny the gospel, it's astounding. How much more? You know, you have a love for Torah, how much more the gospel? For if the message spoken by angels is binding and every violation and disobedience receives this punishment, how shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation? This salvation which was first announced by the Master, Yeshua, was confirmed to us by those who heard him. God also testified to it by signs and wonders and various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to his will. Well, the story I told you plays an important part in this text, Hebrews chapter 2. I don't think the story I told the children is kind of like the key to unlocking Hebrews 2. It's a story that was told by Yehoshua ben Levi, who lived a long time after the book of Hebrews was written, but he's probably telling a story that's much older than himself. Let me read it to you this time, you know, straight out of the Cincino version of the Talmud. It says, Rabbi Joshua ben Levi also said, when Moses ascended on high, the ministering angel spake before the Holy One, blessed be he, sovereign of the universe. What business has one born of women amongst us? He has come to receive the Torah, answered he to them. said they to him, "That secret treasure which has been hidden by thee for 974 generations before the world was created, thou desirest to give it to flesh and blood? What is man that thou art mindful of him, the son of man that thou visitest him? O Lord our God, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, who has set thy glory," that is the Torah, "thy glory, upon the heavens." So the angels are quoting Psalm 8 to prove to God that mankind is not worthy of the Torah, because mankind is made lower than the angels, and the Torah, his glory, is set in the heavens, where angels hang out. Okay? So that's they're using the Bible to argue with God. That's fair. Returned them an answer, bade the Holy One, blessed be he, to Moses. "Sovereign of the universe," replied he, "I fear lest they consume me with the breath of their mouths." "Hold on to the throne of glory," said he to them, and returned them an answer. He then spake before them, "Sovereign of the universe, the Torah which thou gavest me, what is written therein? I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt," said he to the angels. "Did ye go down into Egypt? Were ye enslaved by Pharaoh? Why then should the Torah be yours? Again, what is written therein? Thou shalt have no other gods, though ye dwell among peoples that engage in idolatry. Again, what is written in there? Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So do you then perform work that you need rest? Again, what is written therein? Thou shalt not take the name in vain. Is there any oath-taking among you? Again, what is written in there? Honor thy father and mother. Have ye fathers and mothers? Again, what is written therein? Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Is there jealousy among you? Is the evil inclination among you? Straightway they conceded to the Holy One, blessed be he. For it is said, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. In the earth. Meaning the Torah will go down to the earth. Based upon this story comes the rabbinic saying that you'll encounter again and again in the Talmud, Torah is not for angels. The sages will be arguing. They'll get into an argument where it's like the standard is being set too high. And then a sage will object and say, but Torah is not for angels. Give us a break here. The writer of Hebrews seems to assume we're already familiar with that axiom in these stories, because quoting the same proof text from Psalm 8, he says in verse 5, it is not to angels that he has subjected the world to come, about which we are speaking. But there is a place where someone has testified. You ever notice Paul does this and as well? Somewhere it is written, and you're like, what? He doesn't know where it's written? But you have to remember, there were no chapters or verses in those days. It was just, you just quoted the piece of scripture, because everyone had it memorized. That was how you did Bible study. Somewhere it is written, what is man that thou art mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor and put everything under his feet. Let me summarize what we're learning. The Torah is steadfast, eternal, and binding. That's what the writer of this epistle said. The writer of this epistle to the Hebrews depends upon that as the foundation for his theology and his warning. The Hebrews community who are to receive this letter regard the Torah as unchanging, given by angels, sealed by blood. The Hebrews community is strictly observant. As the book of the Acts points out, every one of them zealous for the Torah. So the writer of the book of Hebrews says, good for you. You should be zealous for the Torah spoken through angels. But how much more so should you be zealous for the gospel, for the message of Messiah, who is greater than angels? We learn from the Talmud, the Torah was not given to angels, but to men. How much more so, Olam Haba, the world to come, is not given to angels, but to human beings. Verse 5 again. It says, It is the world to come about which we are speaking. That's important. That's another key to working with this whole book. We're talking about Olam Haba. Not necessarily talking about right now. It is the world to come about which we are speaking. Just as Moses took the Torah from the realm of angels and gave it to men, so too, this second Moses, this Yeshua, this one who has a title that is above angels, has taken the world to come from the realm of angels and has delivered it to human beings. That's the message. What is man that you are mindful of him, the Son of Man that you care for him? You made him. The Son of Man. You made him. The Son of Man, a little lower than the angels. And you crowned him with glory and honor and put everything under his feet. May he who makes peace in his high places make peace upon us. Let's turn in our siddurs. To the Avinu on page 27.
Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Lead us not into temptation. Deliver us from all evil. Lead us not into temptation. Deliver us from all evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever in the name of Yeshua righteousness forever. Yeshua, righteousness.
Rise to the closing benediction.
Our God and God of our fathers, bless us with the triune blessing in the Torah, which was given by the hand of Moses, your servant, pronounced by Aaron and his sons, the priests, your holy people, and spoken by Yeshua, your Messiah. As it is written, and he led them out as far as Bethany, and he lifted up his hands and blessed them. And he said, Yivarechecha Adonai, Veishmerecha, Ya'er Adonai panavelecha, Vichunecha, Yisah Adonai, panavelecha, Veyasimlecha, Shalom. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face toward you and give you shalom. And it came to pass, while he blessed them, he was parted from them and carried up into heaven.